There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Readers recommend.
There are only so many books that we can read each week, Yvette. So it really helps when we have someone come in and recommend a whole stack of them to make up for all that time that we just don't have to read.
Absolutely.
That many books every single week. So joining us this week is Director of Communications at Dubai Properties and bookworm, more importantly, Jamal Al-Mawad. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, good to be back.
See, we couldn't keep you away.
No, I couldn't stay away.
So last time you were on the show, we had some great nonfiction recommendations from you, and you have a whole heap more to go through. Would you mind kicking us off with the first book on that little pile of yours there?
Yes, we have a wide range today. I think we'll start off with a bit of a fun one, which is 21st Century Dodos by Steve Stack. So obviously the dodo is an extinct bird. And the idea of this book is he's looking at some of the things from the 70s and 80s and 90s that will no longer exist soon or already don't exist. And it's a bit of a nostalgia trip for people who grew up in the 80s and 90s.
And the 70s.
And the 70s.
And it's like, look at me over here.
Just saying.
And yeah, there's some stuff that actually had already passed me by, which I didn't really understand. And then there's some stuff that's just straight away you look at and think, has that already gone, you know, out of existence? One of the funny ones that I straight away remembered is the house phone. So having a phone in the house, some people still do. But if you remember the old days or when we were younger where everyone was sharing the same phone, and if you wanted to speak to someone, you had to wait for someone else to get off, or you'd open the phone and they'd be on it and so on. It just disappeared, and you don't realize these things have stopped happening suddenly. Another one that I thought was funny was roller skates. I haven't seen them for a while. I think they were big in the 70s and 80s.
Roller skates?
I think they're having a resurgence, to be honest. There's a roller skate club
roller
here.
Skates, roller blades?
Yeah.
Is there a difference?
Well, roller blades is more modern,
that's
slightly.
More modern, isn't it? But roller skates, gosh. Yeah.
I haven't seen skates for a while.
No.
I know someone who does roller skate quite a bit. Yeah.
And there's one that was funny for me, which I hadn't realized as well, was the ring pull on cans of Coke mm-hmm. or Pepsi or something coming off all the way. So yeah. The actual ring pull. And I was trying to remember when I read this, I said, did they used to come off? And then I remembered
they did. Yeah.
They used to come off all the way. And the reason they were stopped was twofold. One was on the streets of Europe and the US specifically, they were becoming more prevalent than even cigarette butts on the floor. And they were, if you remember, they were really sharp.
They were sharp.
Yeah, they were awful.
I have had cuts from those.
Yeah, you would get cut, just take it off.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's strange that took a while to get out of fashion, but those have stopped now, completely extinct, dodos.
On that though, I still remember having the ones that came all the way off when I was little in Jordan, in Amman. They would be one kind of ring pull. And it was like it was phased out in different parts of the world at different rates. Because when we went back to visit people in the UK, they had the ones where they didn't come off at all.
Yeah, well, absolutely. The things tend to stay a bit longer in the Middle East before they get phased out. One that was funny for me was smoking in cinemas.
Gosh, yes.
Yeah.
And on planes as well.
And on
planes. I remember smoking on planes. Not myself, but... And one that's really funny for me, I'm not sure if you'll remember it, but I think the men will all remember, is the chest expander, which was this, it was this funny.
Charles Atlas.
Yeah, the workout thing, which was these four springs tied to a thing and you would extend it and supposedly have this, ripped chest. And it was so funny because they were in every single house.
They were.
It was absolutely pointless, did nothing, but it stuck around for so long. And I remember having those at home and trying to use them as a child and thinking, oh, my dad's so strong, he can use this.
The chest expander.
Blackboards, shame, they've gone out of, almost completely gone out of fashion. In the modern world, let's say, blackboards with chalk.
Chalkboards, yeah.
So it's now just whiteboards.
It's whiteboards now, yeah. If that even, because I know in some of the modern schools now, everything's done digitally on iPads.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, just a smart screen.
Smart screen. There's no central board, actually, that the teacher writes on. The children sit on circular tables together, and they use their iPads to interact.
I know. See,
I feel
remember,
like so much has you look, changed.
You look, you're looking
I'm
at me in
really
horror.
Old.
I remember having a rolling blackboard chalkboard as well. So yeah, it wasn't just one on the wall. It was one on a, so you could just write, you know, for A-level notes and notes just going round and round. My goodness.
Yeah.
Writing on those was an art. That's a lost art form as well.
Does anyone remember teletext, CFAX?
Yeah.
Yeah. Gone now. That was the early version of finding out
score.
Yeah,
Annabelle's looking totally bemused.
She's absolutely in shock.
And I was doing my library training, in fact, when that was really big in the UK, certainly. And it was just, you could get everything on there.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll tell you why I was so fascinated by it. Because when I was younger, it was the only way to find out the football scores.
Yep.
And so you would go on and see what the updated scores are. And obviously then the internet came along or became more widespread. And it died a quick death, CFAX and teletext.
Yeah.
Obvious ones, cassette tapes, VHS tapes and so on. But what I thought was funny is they've made a resurgence as well as being kind of vintage. And I was in Virgin Megastores the other day. I noticed that they have cassette tapes back for new albums. Yeah. And I think it's just, I think it's a gimmicky thing because I don't know where you would play them.
Because I knew they were doing this with vinyl. So modern artists, they were bringing out on vinyl, which I understand. But now they're doing it with cassette.
They are, yeah. And what's funny is when they got the vinyl back, they also got the record players back as well. Yep. So you'd have that in your house as a vintage thing. But they haven't got cassette players back. So I don't know what the objective is.
I've got one in storage in the UK. If anybody wants one, I'm happy to, you know, pull that up for the highest bidder. But you know, cassette tapes stretched as well. I mean, they distorted the sound as well, and they were great for children. Matthew Judge, actually unraveling the entire thing.
Yeah, that was.
Are they selling them with the free pencil? Because
exactly. many a cassette tape.
I'm just imagining a lot of young people who've never like had them before going, oh, I'm going to buy a cassette, and then like not knowing how to fix them when they go wrong.
And there was a meme going around before, I remember, which had a picture of a cassette and a pencil next to it. Yeah. And it said, if you don't understand this, then you're too young.
Yes.
So yeah, and there's lots of other ones that are funny. Sony Walkman, and then followed by the Discman, which was the first time you could listen to music, obviously, on the go.
I had a Discman.
The Discman was terrible, though. Do you remember? Because a Walkman made sense, because even if you moved it around and jogged it, it wouldn't change the, you know, the music wouldn't stop.
Right. The Discman.
But a Discman, discs were very, they're played by laser. So anytime you moved, it would jog and stop playing.
Yeah, that was very frustrating when you were trying to pretend to be Celine Dion in your childhood bedroom. Exactly. Not that I'm speaking from experience.
Neither am I, actually. Might be one you remember, Annabelle. Smash Hits magazine?
No,
she's far too young for Smash Hits magazine.
What was that?
Smash Hits was funny. It was like the pop magazine growing up. But you know what's funny about it, and it's something that I identify with growing up here as well, is that one of the reasons that teenagers used to buy it so much was to get lists of song lyrics. And they used to have,
you could sing along.
And posters as well. And I remember here we had Young Times and Junior News and kind of these kids' magazines. And every time you would write in, it would be people writing in saying, can we have the song lyrics to this song or this song? Because there was no other way to get them.
Yeah.
Because
there were the sort of very serious music magazines like NME and Melody Maker.
But then
Smash Hits was just like, oh, I can understand this. It's not deep esoteric writing about, I don't know,
the fourth chord in the second verse on the B side.
Smash Hits was just fun.
Fold out posters.
Yeah.
It's a bit of fun. 1 cent coins. Now, this is an interesting one because they obviously haven't gone out of circulation yet. But there is a big debate going on about getting rid of them because a 1p coin or a 1 cent coin, they're made from mostly zinc now.
Mm-hmm.
And the production of them actually costs more than what they're worth. So we're actually spending money to make money, but in the wrong way, not in the traditional way you think. And governments keep it going because there's a very powerful zinc lobby in the US.
Wow.
Which is, which preserves that you should keep using zinc. And funnily enough, it is backed by the producers of zinc.
No.
So, that is fascinating.
Exactly. So,
I think it's true that there's an awful lot of lost money floating around in terms of those coins.
And I remember research
what you mean in
about
houses?
That.
Down the back of sofas.
Yes.
The back of sofas. Wishing wells.
Yeah. Wishing wells.
Just dive in and grab a few.
So who would you recommend this book for? Because we need to wrap up with this one now.
I think this is definitely a book for people who grew up 70s, 80s, 90s. It's a nostalgia trip. It's lots of fun. And it's one that you can dive in and out of. Because every single product, every single piece has its own small chapter. And it's just a nice kind of funny light read.
Okay, that is 21st Century Dodos by Steve Stack. What's the next one that you'd like to talk to us about?
All right, the next one is a bit more of a scientific book, but a really interesting topic for me specifically, which is, it's called Tasty, The Art and Science of What We Eat by John McQuaid. And this is an interesting one. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who won his awards for covering the hurricanes in the US and New Orleans and so on, and Hurricane Katrina. And he's jumped to a completely different topic, which is the sense of taste. And he argues in it that it hasn't been given its scientific importance over the years because there's so much focus on sight and sound and smell and so on, and scent. And taste has been slightly ignored. And he goes on a very kind of scientific in-depth look at how taste is affected. And the first thing he starts off with, which is I think what people will find most interesting, is that the taste map that we all read in the biology books at school, which shows that your tongue is divided into four different sections, which has at the tip of it you've got sweet, and I think at the back it's bitter and so on and salty, that was literally a fluke that happened in a scientific test 50 years ago, I think, and it just got taken up and became something widespread.
Are you telling us it's not true?
It's absolutely not true because
I can feel my whole world crumbling around me.
The taste receptors are all over the tongue, and there are hundreds of thousands of them, and they're spread evenly. So there's no specific place where you can taste, for example, sweet versus salty in a more so than anywhere else. The other thing is that we've always been led to believe that there are four main tastes, which are sweet, salty, bitter, sour. There is actually a fifth, and now a sixth one. The fifth one is called umami. And it's basically savory. And savory is what you would maybe taste, for example, when you're eating roast beef or something that has that kind of, it's difficult to explain, but savory kind of taste. And why it's so key is that the savory taste buds are the ones that actually help also bring out the flavors of the other four. And so umami is actually probably the most important of the five taste buds that we have. And the sixth one, which has just been discovered and which is now becoming more understood in science, interestingly, is the taste of fat.
What?
So there is a sixth taste receptor or taste bud, which is the taste of fat, which is separate to the other ones. And it's another one that people can taste, but difficult for you to differentiate from the other ones.
See, it's like the sequel to the sixth sense.
Yes.
Yeah, and maybe a seventh taste. One coming up. So he talks about the different types of taste, and also the importance of the sense of disgust, which is when you don't like the taste of something, and how that's helped different cultures have different kind of views of food. And he says something which I found very interesting. He says, taste is the only sense that is programmed by genes, because all of our senses are programmed by our genes, but it's molded by culture and experience. So your vision the way you hear and smell, that doesn't change with time. You know, maybe you start to like different things, but taste, your sense of taste does change.
That's really interesting. And remind us of the title of this one again.
It's Tasty, The Art and Science of What We Eat by John McQuaid.
The Art and Science of What We Eat. Any thoughts on that before we move on a bit?
I'm just thinking about our tastes change. And I think it's true, but I have no scientific information to back this up, that children have, or very young children have, much more developed and sensitive taste receptors to adults, oh, yeah, which is why
they reject things like broccoli.
Yes, I still am. I remember as a child loathing mushrooms.
Yeah,
I loathe mushrooms too.
But now I love them. Really like them. Yeah. And I do just about manage to eat broccoli now. But I genuinely do think that my aversion to any brassica family vegetables.
Well, you say that's interesting. Actually, an elevated sense of taste is usually associated with being much more receptive to the bitter taste. So people who are super tasters, which means that they can sense that they have a much more advanced sense of taste, they actually, the bitter taste for them is much stronger. On the other side, you have non-tasters who tend to not feel the bitter so much. And usually they would be the people who enjoy the taste of alcohol, which is very bitter. And as a human instinct, doesn't taste good. But non-tasters, for them, it becomes something normal.
We actually have an interesting story about super tasters, because we had Gennaro Pelliccia, I think that's how you pronounce his name, come to the festival for our Costa debate session this year at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature. and he had his tongue insured for £10 million because he samples products for Costa Coffee, and his tongue is so, he's such a super taster that he had his tongue insured because that's kind of how he earns a living.
It's a good talent to have.
It certainly is.
And you know, and going back to that, before we wrap up actually on this book, the sense of pain is also something that's enjoyed by people within taste. And that comes back to heat and chilies, for example, heat, chilies don't activate any of your taste receptors. They activate your pain receptors. And some people enjoy that. And there's continuous competitions happening around the world to create the hottest chili. And it's done through very kind of long processes of breeding the chilies and so on. And there's a British guy called Ed Curry, which is a great name for somebody who breeds chilies. And he's been busy doing this for a while. And just to give you an idea, a normal jalapeno is 2,500 Scoville units. That's how you measure the heat of a chili. He managed to create something called the Red Savina, which is 200 times hotter than that. And then a Trinidadian one was discovered called the Moruga Scorpion, which is 1.5 million Scoville units. And finally, Ed created the hottest one in the world right now, which is the Carolina Reaper, which is 2.2 million Scoville units. So it's 300 times hotter than a jalapeno.
And some people can actually manage to eat.
It's very dangerous to eat, but some people can eat it, yes.
Why would you want to do
that? I was
that?
Just going to say.
Do not get that at all.
Like, I understand loving spicy food, but that's taking it a little too far.
Somebody message in, please, and explain 4001 why you would want to do that.
Wait, you said his name was Ed Curry?
His name is Ed Curry, yeah.
Well, that made me wonder whether there are some people in the world who are born with these names and end up going down a certain path because of the names that they have, or whether it is just coincidence.
What, like me being called Yvette and going to live in France, that sort of thing?
Oh, no. Yeah.
There's a connection.
Or if you'd have become a judge.
Yeah. Oh,
God. You know what I mean? That
judge
kind
Yvette.
Of thing. What's the third book that you'd like to talk to us about?
The third book is actually a brand new one, and a very interesting one, I think, for me personally, and maybe for lots of the listeners, which is How to Turn Down $1 Billion, The Snapchat Story by Billy Gallagher.
Now, generally speaking, I'd say turning down $1 billion would be a bad idea.
You would think, until you read the book.
Now, the thing is, though, with Snapchat, I saw that you were going to talk about this book, but Snapchat, I'm not on Snapchat, just full disclosure. Are you?
I am, yes, yeah.
You are? What about you, Yvette?
No, I don't get Snapchat. And sorry, Isabel, our CEO, Isabel Abulhall, who I know is a big Snapchat fan.
I find
so,
it hilarious.
Puts me to shame, but yeah.
That I'm not on Snapchat. I don't understand it. Never have. Never will. And yet Isabel is on it all
with,
the time.
You know, with her children and grandchildren.
So my generation's like the poster child for Snapchat. And I can't get on with it. I don't find it intuitive in any way whatsoever. Yeah. But please tell me about this book, all about it.
Well, on that note, I'll try and make Snapchat interesting. I think, look, you said something really key there, which is you said, I don't find it intuitive.
Yeah.
Now, here's what's interesting about this. Snapchat as an app and as a brand has only been in existence now for 6 years. It was launched at the end of 2011. The creator is Evan Spiegel, and his co-creator was Bobby Murphy. And they created this from their dorms in Stanford University in the US. He purposely made sure that it wasn't intuitive as an interface, because what he believed is that for it to catch on amongst younger people and for it to be something interesting, there had to be a sense of touch. There had to be a sense of discussing it, not just downloading it in isolation and trying it out and either liking it or not. So what he wanted was that your friends show you how to use it. And anyone who's downloaded and used Snapchat and become a Snapchatter, you ask them how they started using it. Nobody messed around with the phone and figured it out. Somebody shows you and says, well, look, this is how you do this and this. Because there are so many hidden features that you wouldn't know and that you can't even look up online properly without someone showing them to you. So that was, I think, one of the very clever decisions he made and why it's different. So what's this book about? It's about the story of how they created the Snapchat app and how they turned into a multi-billion dollar enterprise there is now. There's a few things that I found interesting about the journey that you read in this book. First of all, for people like me who lived through this, because it's recent history, it's not something that's 20, 30 years ago. It's something that happened in the last 5, 6 years. So every new product that was unrolled on Snapchat, unveiled, I was there. It was happening to me when I opened it one day and got surprised and said, wow, there's now lenses, there's now filters and so on. And you enjoy these moments. And finding out the story behind them of how they came into existence is just really interesting and really funny. There is an element of the social network to it because there was the person who actually invented the idea, Reggie Brown, was one of these three students who created it and was then kicked out by Evan from the beginnings of the app.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
No, why? What did
you do? It'll make a good movie someday. So basically, he came up with the idea and said, let's create an app where the pictures disappear. And that didn't exist before, okay? Because the whole idea behind Facebook and Instagram was that your life is preserved online socially. You know that you post these pictures, you have memories, you go back and see them, people like them, so it's there. And what Reggie was thinking was that it would be great if they just disappear, because it makes it very easier for people who don't want all these memories. He talked to Evan, who's his friend. They started working on the idea. They came up with the name Peekaboo for it. They started working on this for 3-4 months.
I wish they kept it.
Yeah, but they got a cease and desist letter by a British company that had created something called Peektaboo. So they had to change it to Snapchat. But then he wasn't carrying his weight. He wasn't really kind of pulling his weight. So they removed him, and he came back and sued them later for $160 million, which is not bad, considering the company
is that what he got? Is that what
that's
won?
What he got out of it, which isn't much, considering that it's a $30 billion-plus business
I
now.
I could live on that, though.
I'd take that. I'd build my own Pemberley.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, absolutely. Who needs Mr. Darcy?
Exactly.
So there is that. What I found also interesting about it is the constant fights or competition he was having with Facebook. Because what was happening is Facebook with Mark Zuckerberg, they're the giant, they're the ones, you know, that are unbeatable, they have the spending power and so on. Mm-hmm. And he came up with this small app that had such high engagement rate. So it wasn't just the number of users, but the amount of time they're spending on it. And because in Snapchat you get lost in your little private world, you know, you can't look for people on Snapchat. You have to know the person's exact name or phone number to find them. So it's usually friends. And you get lost in it as well. So people were spending hours and hours on it. So Mark Zuckerberg called Evan at one point, Evan at the beginning, and said, I'd like to meet with you. And Evan said, well, anytime you're in town, you know, come over, which was already a bit of a slight back of him because he expected him to fly over to the Facebook offices. So he said, all right, I'm coming in 2 weeks. He came in 2 weeks to where they were based. And he talked to him and he tried to buy Snapchat from him. And Evan said, I'm not interested in selling. So he went back. And he copied Snapchat for Facebook and created an app called Poke, which was literally Snapchat on Facebook. It failed a huge failure because it just didn't have the same privacy that Snapchat had. And so that happened. He came back again and made this famous $1 billion offer, which was actually $3 billion, to try and buy Snapchat again. And again, they turned it down and said, no, we're gonna keep going by ourselves. And so Facebook created something called Slingshot, which was basically the same as Snapchat, but this time, in order to open a photo you received, you had to send one back. Now, that sounds like a great way to make the engagement stay, but it's actually quite awkward because it means you're reacting to a photo that you haven't seen yet. And so it didn't work, also failed, and Snapchat kept growing. And now finally, the last step was that Facebook created Instagram Stories, which is again another Snapchat ripoff, which has taken off. So there's that competition is always in the back of the book. And as you read it, it's very interesting to see how being so loyal to your vision, which is what Evan has, his vision for Snapchat, is that this has to be a private world where the conversation is happening through social and it's not supposed to be preserved. It's supposed to be getting you lost in the experience of communicating, not in the leave behind, which is the perfectly manicured pictures you see on Instagram.
There has been a downside in that you can, I believe... She's pretending she knows what she's talking about. You can screenshot the image. And so that has had some fairly nasty repercussions, I think, for people in terms of what photos they've exchanged. So there's still an element where it's not absolutely perfect. But, yeah, the idea of it not being there in perpetuity
is appealing. Also that it's not curated either.
Mm-hmm.
It feels more social, whereas like Instagram is definitely like a curated photo album. We're going to have to leave it there. Reminders of the titles of all the books that you spoke about for our listeners there.
So we were just talking about How to Turn Down $1 Billion, The Snapchat Story by Billy Gallagher. And before that, we spoke about Tasty, The Art and Science of What We Eat by John McQuaid. And before that, 21st Century Dodos, a collection of endangered objects by Steve Stack.
Jamal, thank you so much for coming back into the studio.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.